Victor Boot is worth an estimated $6 billion, money he's made from shipping everything from flowers to illegal arms. And his clients have ranged from the United Nations to the Taliban. He was arrested 2 years ago, and yesterday he was arraigned on terrorism charges in a New York federal court. Joining me now for a look at Victor Boot is Stephen Braun. He's the national security editor with the Associated Press and co-author of a book about Mr. Boot called Merchant of Death, Money, Guns, Planes, and the Man Who Makes War Possible. I'm very pleased to welcome him back to our show today for today's backstory. Hello.
Hi, Leonard. Thanks for having me back.
We talked about your book 4 years ago when Mr. Boot was still active. He looked invulnerable at the time.
Yep. I never thought I'd see the day when he'd step foot in an American courtroom, but there he was.
Well, how did he get his start?
Boot came out of Russian military intelligence. He was an air officer in the late 1980s. There are reports that he was stationed down in Africa. He's a linguist who spent some of his college years in what's now a closed Russian, was formerly Soviet language academy that was a feeder for the intelligence agencies. And he came out. It's a little murky how he got his first stipend, but he supposedly bought three old creaky Russian air cargo planes and began going from there. He flew a load of pencils, according to his own account, from, I believe, some players in the Mideast to Russia, big shipload of pencils, and went from there, moving all kinds of cargoes, initially licit, but eventually illicit as well.
Flowers, chickens, legal arms.
Flowers, chicken, gladiolas, all kinds of, electronics, all kinds of material.
And did he continue doing that after he got involved with illegal arms trafficking?
Yeah, that was the genius of the system. He was sort of like Milo Minderbinder in Joseph Heller's Catch-22. The sort of adage among air cargo flyers is never fly empty. And he flourished to a fairly well doing that. He'd always make sure that if he was flying from point A to point B, that he'd have something on the plane. It could be a large shipment of IGLA, surface-to-air missiles, or rifles, or it could be gardenias. It could be frozen chickens. It could be coltan, which was an element that was used in cell phones in the 1980s and 1990s.
Well, and he always seemed. Go ahead.
It could be anything, and he was just he and his crews were. We're very adept at making sure that those cargo holds were always filled with something.
And it didn't matter who the client was, it seems. He shipped goods for Halliburton and KBR as well as the UN and then was a supplier for the Taliban. He's flown aid to tsunami victims in other areas. Were people aware that he was always willing to work for the other side?
In some cases, apparently so. In Angola, at one point, the government was stunned to learn that he was flying for warlords fighting against the government because the government was also using them to fly for them. So, and that became apparently a similar case in Afghanistan when he began. He had been flying initially for the established government in Afghanistan in the early 1990s, and then switched sides and flew for the Taliban. But in some cases, folks didn't know. I mean, the U.S. military claims that they were unaware that he was flying for them frequently, his planes were flying for them frequently into Baghdad for the U.S. government in the early 2000s because they insisted that he was using two and three and four party contractors, and so they thought they were contracting with a UAE-based air firm, for example, and they ended up getting him instead.
Well, you mentioned that he had been in Africa, and it seems like a lot of his business was in various African countries, including Liberia, Sierra Leone, Democratic Republic of Congo, countries that have been torn apart by civil wars. Could some of those civil wars have succeeded without his help?
That's a good question. There are folks in the UN who believe that those wars would have been, they may still have been conflicts, but they would have been far more stunted conflicts if his arms did not play a part in them, particularly in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where he aided several warlord factions, and also in Liberia, where he almost had free run of Charles Taylor's palace there. You know, he was an integral part of those operations.
And he wasn't even a fashion model. Are there other arms traffickers who operate in as many countries and regions?
There are some. In fact, one of the arms dealers who was arrested just prior to him, a Syrian by the name of Manzer al-Kassar, and who was also extradited to the United States and convicted, and in fact was brought down by the same agency, the DEA. Al-Kassar similarly, transported arms to a number of countries. The difference with Boot and the difference between him and almost every other major arms dealer that's come down the pike is that Boot pioneered essentially an all-service arms enterprise, in which not only did he make sure that he got them the weapons themselves, but he took care of the transport, he took care of the training of the people who needed to know how to use the weapons. For example, in the current case, the U.S. is going to claim that he had offered to train these fictitious FARC members on how to shoot down American planes. So it was almost sort of the Walmart, if you will, of the arms business.
I'm talking with Stephen Braun, National Security Editor with the Associated Press, co-author of Merchant of Death, Money, Guns, Planes, and the Man Who Makes War Possible, about Victor Boot, our subject on the first of today's backstory segments. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Why did the United States, after all these years, decide that now was the time to try to capture him?
Well, I think there was somewhat of a sea change towards the end of the Bush administration. They had been embarrassed by the fact that it had been exposed by, at the time, my newspaper, which was the Los Angeles Times, and some other European newspapers, that there were dozens and dozens of flights on behalf of the U.S. government into Iraq, flying in everything from arms, again, to mail, frozen food, you name it. And there was somewhat of a shift in personnel, but there was also another factor that hasn't been written about a lot, but there was some heft given to the Drug Enforcement Administration, which was primarily at that point an anti-narcotics organization. But because of the existence of a number of narco-terrorist cartels, among them the FARC in South America, they were given an expanded ability to target some of these enterprises, what they call transnational criminal enterprises, abroad. And so they began searching around, and they first went after, as I just mentioned, this Syrian named Al-Kassar, and it worked like a charm. And then they took the same operation and used it exactly, everything down to almost the same informants, and they used it against Boot, and it succeeded.
He was quite sophisticated at his trade. Isn't it kind of surprising that he fell for that trap?
It is, and he was known for doing things like throwing away sat phones after using them and talking in code and different languages on the cell phones when he did speak. So he was very careful, but we're talking 15 years. He was out there a long time, and sooner or later you're going to make a slip up, and that's apparently what he did during this caper.
Well, he was arrested in Thailand.
Yes.
But he's only been brought to the United States in the last few days. Was the delay because of the controversy surrounding his extradition?
Yeah, he was arrested in March of 2008 by Thai police, assisted by U.S. agents in a hotel room in Bangkok. Immediately, almost from the day, the Russian government in the United States entered into a tug of war. And the Thais, who were ostensibly an American ally, they were sort of caught in the middle of this, and they didn't want to antagonize either government. And so what ended up was this sort of stasis situation where for month after month after month, Boot, would sit in the jail cell while these diplomats would huddle with Thai diplomats and try to, sweeten, their deals and persuade them to move them around. And it only became clear basically in about the last 2 weeks that the Americans had finally truly gained the upper hand. And by last week, we're told American officials were highly confident that Boot would get into their custody.
Well, hasn't Russia's foreign ministry claimed that he's an innocent businessman? I mean, how can they, considering what we know about him?
Well, here's the irony is that all these years, and as we wrote in our book, Boot was, you know, he was, there was just enormous evidence to show that, in fact, he was involved in a number of these arms deals. The problem is that the international laws against it were so murky that, number one, it would be very difficult to put together a clear case for you know, unless it was happening within a particular country and that government decided to go after him. In most cases, Boot was you know, far from Russia and was involved in these countries in Africa, which either had no laws or had very weak laws. And then the other problem was a lack of international will. I mean, from you know, our government to all the others, there was just not a strong sense that that he was on top of everybody's radar screen.
Well, he's a former military officer. There have been indications that he had connections with people who are high up in Russian intelligence service. Do you think the Russians are worried that about what he might say and who he might implicate?
Oh, I think they are definitely worried about that. Well, in fact, in one of the AP stories that ran just the other day, his own lawyers said that that Boot had already told him that the Americans had offered in exchange for his cooperation to sweeten, you know, the deal if he did come into their custody. And his brother Sergei, who is a key figure in his operation, said ominously that he worried that the United States or American agents would inject him with something that would make him more cooperative. So clearly the Russians are very concerned.
He was arraigned in New York City federal court yesterday. What charges is he facing?
He's charging conspiracy and abetting a terrorist enterprise. And Mondrian Kassar was put away. I'm not sure what the exact sentence was. It's not in front of me, but for a considerable amount of time. And if they can persuade a jury that he did that, that could put him away for an indefinite period. In addition to that, they've also charged him with a number of money laundering counts as well, and those could also put him away for quite some time.
Is there a sense of how strong the U.S. case is against him?
Well, again, the Al-Qassar case, if it's any guide, at least in that case, a federal jury, you know, accepted the basic premise that you could, you know, mount a sting operation against an international arms dealer and make it stick. The question is, in this case, are there extenuating circumstances? There may be a concern here that he may raise his own, you know, working relationship with the United States government in Iraq. That could potentially complicate things. And then there's always the question of, you know, will a judge in this case allow a lot of the wiretaps? Most of these were judicially approved, but, you know, will they be allowed to take a role in the trial?
Isn't part of the case against him that he told what he thought were FARC people in the sting, that he was glad that they'd be using the arms against the United States? Should we assume that he actually felt that way, or was it likely to just have been part of his sales pitch?
It could likely be both. I mean, the sales pitch, you know, if you want to juice up your relationship with someone you believe is a natural enemy of the United States, that would clearly be something you'd want to tell them. But over the years, Boot has sort of dripped contempt for the United States. I mean, going back to the early 2000s, which, in fact, at that point, the United States had really made no strong effort to go after him. And then as they began to, clearly he began to perceive them as a foe. So, you know, he's had that attitude. His brother has expressed that attitude as well.
Aren't some people upset that the case will focus on Colombia when he was also a major supplier to rebel and terrorist groups throughout the world?
You mean in terms exclusively on the Colombia case?
Yes.
Well, yeah, I think there is, you know, there are folks who would like to see some part of that trial focus on what happened in Africa, focus on what happened in his secret dealings with the Taliban. Although the feds are not tipping their hand yet about what they're going to do, it's likely that there will at least be some sort of a part during the trial, perhaps when they introduce one of the informants in the case, where they'll try to sort of broaden their profile of him and for the jury to make them understand the world in which he moved and the kind of damage that he did. So I think we'll get some of that in the trial. I just don't think we're going to get a lot of it.
Who are the informants? Are we talking about former associates? Are they likely to come forward to testify against him?
There's one named Andrew Smulian, and he was part of the sting operation. The feds nabbed him when they nabbed Boot in the hotel room, and Smulian quickly flipped and became an informant for the U.S. government. What makes him particularly interesting is not only does he, you know, or would he know a lot of the details of this case, but my understanding is that Smulian was involved with Boot going back to when Boot worked out of South Africa in the late 1990s. That would indicate a long familiarity with Boot's operation and the way it worked. And again, this is where we may find out more about how Boot worked in Africa and in Central Asia.
Congress is balking at endorsing a new arms deal, arms treaty. What about this trial? Could that also damage efforts to repair the U.S.-Russian relationship?
This is the key question. This is the most interesting question here, and it's while everybody on the United States side is you know tries to be very reassuring that this is going to go to trial, there is going to be tremendous pressure from the Russians. This administration, the Obama administration, wants to get what it calls a reset with the Russians, much warmer relations. But the Russians may well say that the cost of that deal may be that they want their man back. And there are a number of folks who think that what may well happen here is what happened with the recent Soviet spy swap. And what happened there was that these sleeper cell agents were essentially hustled into court. They pled to a much lower charge, agreed never to do it again, and then were shipped home. And there's some belief that we may see that happen in Boot's case. So in that case, he may never go to trial.
And then he claims, at least at yesterday's arraignment, that he's certain he'll be fully exonerated. Well, we'll see, right? Stephen Braun is the national security editor with the Associated Press, co-author of Merchant of Death, Money, Guns, Planes, and the Man Who Makes War Possible. And we've been talking about Victor Boot on today's first Backstory segment. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.